don't want to spend too much time on a review, or else I'll run into the same problem that I seem to run into on most sermons, and that is running out of time. But just as a brief reminder for those that were here, and also for those that maybe weren't here last time, as we've come to chapter 7, we've come to a new section, in a way, of Paul's epistle to the Corinthians. He's been dealing with some issues in the first five chapters, first six chapters, that he's heard about, things that have been reported by Chloe and her household, and perhaps even others. And in chapter 7, he begins addressing things concerning things that they had written to him. Now, whether these were questions that they honestly asked Paul, whether these were things that they wrote kind of as a matter of fact that he's correcting, that's up for debate, and we might not know fully. But he is, at this point, addressing some things that they have written to him. Now, he set the foundation for this in chapter 6. Remember, at the end of chapter 6, Paul dealt with, there in verses 12 through 20, the very grave nature of sexual immorality and how heinous of a sin it is and how much of a danger it is. And that really sets the tone for chapter 7. And it seems like that there's maybe a couple of different opinions in the Corinthian congregation. And he uses that to set the foundation to correct some problems, but also to then launch into another group of people he needs to address. Remember, Corinth is apparently quite divided, and there's a lot of division, and Paul spent much of the first four chapters dealing with that. And chapter 6 and 7 might show us where some of that division occurred. In chapter 6, you really get the impression, especially with the chapter 5, the man who was living in a very immoral way and was being tolerated. And then chapter 6, how much Paul focuses on sexual immorality. It seems that there may have been there that were very flippant about the sin of immorality or the various sins of immorality. But on the other side, it seems that there were those in Corinth that swung to the other end of the pendulum. And one thing that people need to understand, and we need to understand, is extremes are typically wrong in both spheres. Being too liberal is wrong, but also being stricter than what God's law calls for is wrong as well. And it seems that there were people in Corinth that had this view towards sexual relations that even amongst married individuals, they held this idea that it is right or good or proper to abstain from sexual relations even in the bounds of marriage. And Paul spends the first seven verses addressing married individuals and showing that that physical relationship is a part of their marriage relationship. And so it's not good for them to abstain from one another. And he goes through the reasons why and gives them reasons why. But then he's going to start addressing other groups and throughout chapter 7. We looked at this last time. He talks about sexual relations between married couples in the first seven verses. Then he talks to unmarried couples for just or unmarried individuals for a couple of verses. The focus of our subject tonight are going to be back on married individuals, but he's going to address those that are married to Christians and those that are married to non-Christians. Then he'll get to that kind of anchor passage, which is ironic because it's really not about marriage, and yet it is the theme of the entire chapter, that Christians are to live as they are called. And that really is the whole theme and premise of all of chapter 7. And then he'll deal with virgins particularly, and then wives and widows in the last couple of verses. So we've seen the first couple sections, that of married couples and their relationship, and then the unmarried and the widows in verses 8 through 9. But that leads us now to verses 10 and 11. Now Paul says in verses 10 through 11, he says, "Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and a husband is not to divorce his wife." And so now at this point, Paul has addressed the married individuals for a specific purpose. He's addressed unmarried individuals and widows, which I think I mentioned last time, very likely is actually aimed at widowers and widows, is probably the focus of verses 8 and 9. And now Paul turns his attention back to the married. But he's going to have a different focus than what was verses 1 through 7. See, whereas there were some that were apparently seeking or promoting the idea that even married individuals should abstain from sexual relations in marriage, others were seemingly supportive of or actively engaging in trying to dissolve their marriages. So it wasn't just taking this ascetic view towards physical relationship and marriage. Some actually thought that they needed to dissolve their marriages and were looking to divorce their spouse. Now, perhaps they sought a divorce to avoid the temptation of sex. If they thought that it was wrong, even in the bonds of marriage, maybe they felt that the temptation was too much. And so they thought that they needed to put away their spouse because of this new doctrine that they had come up with. Or maybe they sought divorce because their spouse didn't hold the same view that they did. That would cause some problems in a marriage if one spouse looked to abstinence perpetually and one spouse did not. And thus they felt that they needed to put their spouse away. Whatever the specific reasons, we might not be sure, but clearly there are some issues with divorce that are either about to happen or are starting to happen, and Paul addresses that. Now, notice Paul says, I command. Paul is not giving a suggestion here. Paul is not speaking in a matter of consent. You know, back in the first few verses, in verses 5 and 6, after he had told why, you know, the whole idea of it is good not to touch a woman in marriage was wrong, and he gave out the reasons why there should be a sexual relationship, he gave a kind of a hypothetical situation where he consented that there could be a period of time, a brief period of time, where a husband and wife could mutually agree to part from one another sexually for a while for prayer. But he was only consenting to that. That was not a command. He allowed that, strictly qualified. But now Paul begins this verse and he says, I command. This is not consent. This is not a suggestion. This is not a guideline. The words that are about to follow are a command. They were meant that way for the Corinthians, and I believe they are meant that way for us as well. Now, the next phrase is what causes some people some problems, especially in a couple verses later when we find Paul flip this. He says, now to the rest, to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. Now, does that mean that there are times when Paul is giving a command and it's Paul's command, but not the Lord's command? Well, no, not at all. Paul was an apostle, and we talked about that a little bit back in the opening verses. Paul had already staked the claim of apostleship, that this letter that he was writing to the Corinthians was not Paul's suggestions. It was not Paul's own will. It was the words of God. It was the words of Christ as an apostle of Jesus Christ. He was writing unto them. And so all of Paul's commands carry the weight and the authority of the Lord. So why does Paul specifically at this point say that it is from the Lord that this command he is giving, or that this command he is giving is from the Lord? Well, Paul, I think, in fact, I'm positive, is alluding to the fact that the command he is about to give is a command that Jesus gave when he was here on this earth. Paul can point the Corinthians to the very words of Jesus when Jesus was here, living, walking, and teaching among men. This is not something that was just delivered through inspiration. Now, that's powerful enough, but this isn't something that had just been revealed to Paul. This is something that Jesus had taught upon in his own ministry. Remember in Matthew 5 and 32, Jesus said, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. So Jesus had taught on divorce amongst people when he was living. And Jesus had said, to divorce your wife for any reason other than sexual immorality is to cause her to commit adultery, and to then have another woman would be adultery. He would also say in Matthew 19, verses 4 through 6 and verse 9, he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. That is as crystal clear as you can get. And Jesus did not refer to a custom. Jesus did not refer to a tradition. And thus, when Paul refers to the commands and the words of Jesus, he's using the same authority that Jesus used. And where did Jesus go to teach on marriage? He didn't teach about Jewish custom. He didn't teach about Gentile custom. He went all the way back to creation. And he said, in the beginning, God created man and he created woman. And his desire was that they should leave a mother and father and they should come and they should become one flesh. They would enter that one flesh union of marriage. And then he said, what therefore God has put together, let not man separate. That's an emphatic command. Marriage is not to be ended. Now, Jesus gave an exception. He said, except for the case of sexual immorality. But the guilty party needs to take very careful attention because the command is still the same, let not man separate what God has joined together. And when we commit sexual immorality, if we commit adultery in marriage, we are actively destroying the marriage bond. We are separating what God has joined together. That's why Jesus gave that exception. We talked about the idea of being, acting as one body with another, with that whole idea of being one flesh and why that is such an important thing. And we don't have the right to join our body to another person outside of marriage. And so someone who does that destroys the family. They destroy the marriage. Now, it can be remedied if they will repent and if they will seek forgiveness and then the spouse forgives them. But when they engage in that activity and persist in that, they separate the marriage. And that's a very serious thing because that's going directly against God's command of you do not separate what God has joined together. That's the command. And Paul is re-emphasizing that command. The command is very clear. Christians are not to seek divorce. Now again, Jesus gave that exception, but I don't want to spend much time on that tonight because Paul doesn't even allude to the exception. Because Paul's focus to the Corinthians has nothing to do with the exception and with remarriage. And that's an important point. And I want you to remember that point because we're going to come back to that here in just a little bit. The Corinthian problem was not, do we have the right to remarry? They weren't wanting to get remarried. They weren't wanting to be married. They just wanted to get divorced. And so what Paul is focusing on is that remarriage is not in the question right now. Now, he's going to give some commands about that to a degree, but that's not the primary focus of what Paul is teaching on because they weren't seeking that. What they were seeking was this ideal of theirs of no sex in their marriage, which seemed to be driving their view of marriage, and thus they were seeking a divorce. And so Paul is saying, no, that is not right. You do not seek a divorce. You do not act this way. Now, as with every case, and we've mentioned this, Paul has an exception or gives a little bit of an exception. Now, this exception, however, is not much of one because, once again, it is very strongly qualified. He says, even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. Sometimes, and I've seen this happen, you can preach till you're blue in the face and you can tell people what the scriptures say over and over and over again and they're not going to listen. And they're going to do whatever they want anyway. And I really think that's the focus of what Paul's saying here, is he's emphasizing once again the importance of not being separated. Paul knew there would be some that might refuse to abide by the doctrine and they might seek to still live as a Christian even though they had separated. And so Paul says, if she does depart, she is not to be remarried. And that goes for a man too. It's happened before where people have separated and they've not had the right reason to separate. And they've said, well, I'll just live single the rest of my life. Paul says, I can do that. I can separate and I can live single and that's what I'll do. And the weeks and the months and the years march on. And guess what happens? All of a sudden they're lonely and they want to get remarried. And now they start trying to find excuses and reasons to get remarried. Paul says, no. You do not get remarried. If you make that step, you stay that way, or you be reconciled to your husband, or husband, you be reconciled to your wife. That's the goal. I've had people tell me, I had a man tell me one time who was having marital problems with his wife, and immorality. She hadn't done anything immoral. He had no right to leave her or to separate from her. And he said this. He said, I'll just be unmarried the rest of my life. I'll be single. I tried to get him to see the need for reconciliation. No desire. He said, we're not going to reconcile. I don't want to reconcile. We won't reconcile. Well, that's not using what Paul said in 1 Corinthians in the right context. Paul's context is getting to the point of reconciliation. If a woman or a man departs, that is not ideal. And that is not an out for a couple that's having problems. To just part and be single. The goal is reconciliation. And both parties had better take very seriously that if they depart, they are breaking their marriage vows. And they had better not even give a second thought to finding a new spouse down the road. You know, remember, and I think this has to be qualified with what Paul's already said. Remember what Paul said, why Paul, going back to this ascetic view of withdrawal and abstinence and sexual relations, why did Paul say that what were the reasons that Paul gave? Remember, Paul had said, your body is not your own. The husband's body is the wife's, and the wife's body is the husband. He said that those physical relations are the spouse's due. It's something that is due to them. It's something that we owe to them. Well, how is it that you can fulfill that obligation? And how is it that you are abiding by God's design that they are have the authority over your body when you leave? You can't. You can't do it. You're looking at that command and you're just throwing it aside. And you're opening up yourself and your partner to temptation. And that's a very serious thing. When someone leaves, and maybe they have it completely within themselves from that point on, be single the rest of their life and never be tempted. Does their spouse? That should be a serious concern. Now, I'm not justifying in any circumstance a man or a woman committing adultery, even if they're put into a tempting situation. That is their responsibility. But nonetheless, don't we share a little bit in the guilt if we force them into a tempting situation because of our refusal to abide by our vows of marriage? I think Paul indicates that we do. And that's why the goal should always be reconciliation. And that's the end goal for Paul. Now Paul shifts focus a little bit. Verse 12, but to the rest I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And if a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. Now, at this point, Paul shifts gears a little bit. He says, to the rest. Now, Paul's already addressed married people twice now, actually. So who are the rest? Well, he clarifies it, or the context clarifies. Now Paul is speaking to Christians married to non-Christians. What Paul had just been speaking to were Christians married to Christians. Well, it stands to reason. If some thought that they should abstain from physical relations, even amongst Christian spouses, how much more could some of them have thought that physical relations with someone who is a non-believer, someone who is a non-Christian, might taint their own soul, might be a problem, and thus they were looking for abstinence and maybe or probably looking for divorce. Now, here comes that next phrase again that causes people problems. Paul had said, I command, yet not I, but the Lord. And now he says, but to the rest I, not the Lord. Some people look at this and they think that Paul is now giving a suggestion. The last one was a command because it was from the Lord. This one is not from the Lord. And so this is just Paul's opinion. We've already made the statement and we'll make it again. When Paul gives a command as the apostle, he is giving the command of Jesus because he is the apostle of Jesus Christ. So what Paul means here is just as when he said, not I, but the Lord, he was referring to the fact that Jesus specifically spoke about that scenario in his ministry. Now Paul is delivering through inspiration Jesus' will to a situation that Jesus did not speak about specifically while he was on this earth. See, in the context of what Jesus was speaking to the Jews, he was not talking about believers being married to non-believers. He was talking to believers that were married to believers. He was talking to Jews that were married to Jews. So he wasn't addressing the situation that inevitably would and did arise in the church and still can when a believer is married to a non-believer. Because they have obeyed the gospel after they were married. Now you have two people in the world, they're married, then they hear about the gospel, or one of them hears about the gospel, and one chooses to obey the gospel, and the other does not obey the gospel. Now you have a situation of a believer married to an unbeliever. Jesus didn't address that specifically, but he addresses it through the Apostle Paul now. That's all that Paul means when he says, not the Lord, but I. Or I, not the Lord. He's just meaning that Jesus didn't refer to this specifically when he was walking and teaching. But now the Lord is addressing it. Now, one thing that I want to make a note about, and I don't want to get off on a tangent too much because this is not the specific context of this passage. But this passage that we are looking at right now in the next few verses should not, and I repeat, should not be used to justify Christians marrying outside the Lord. Remember the context. Paul is not addressing people that are seeking to get married. Paul is addressing people that are seeking to end their marriage. Also, the circumstance that Paul is addressing is one in which individuals were almost certainly married before they became a Christian. And when they did become a Christian, their spouse did not. That is an entirely different scenario than a Christian that is seeking to get married and chooses willfully to marry someone that is not a Christian. Now, remember, Paul is writing to Corinth, which some scholars think he is only writing within 4 or 5 years since the congregation began. To put that into perspective, imagine that this congregation got started, let's even back it up a little bit further, in 2010. This congregation's been around for what, 50, 60 years? Imagine it's only been around since 2010. And imagine that every person here, every member in this congregation was not their mom and dad weren't Christians. Their grandparents weren't Christians. They heard about the gospel for the first time about 10 years ago. And they obeyed the gospel then. And they weren't even denominational. They were just worldly. That's what Corinth was. You had adults. You had grown, mature people that came to faith and obedience. So you had people that were married. You had people that had families. You had people that had lived their entire lives in paganism or Judaism, and now they were Christians. This is not people that have grown up in the church or are second and third generation people in the church choosing to get married to outsiders. These are people that were married, and when they obeyed the gospel and their husband didn't or their wife didn't, that could cause some problems. That could cause some repercussions for them. And it caused some of them to think that maybe they should end the marriage. That is the context of what Paul is speaking about. And I want to point that out because some people go to this passage to try and justify their desire to marry outside the church. But Paul's commands are the same. He says, let him not divorce her. Now, also, one other point that I want to, I've got this quote on here. Mike Willis, in his commentary, makes this point. He says, those Christians who might be contemplating marriage to a non-Christian should meditate on the fact that they have no basis for appealing for certain patterns of behavior from a non-Christian mate, whereas the Christian partner can be appealed to on the basis of his subjection to Jesus Christ. That command, let him not divorce her and let her not divorce him, who is that to? That is to the Christian. If you notice, from chapter 5 all the way forward, when Paul is dealing with all these situations that have to do with Christians and non-Christians, Paul has absolutely nothing to say to the non-Christians. The case of the man living in an incestuous relationship, almost all commentators agree, the woman, his stepmother, wasn't a Christian. Paul has nothing to say to her. Why? Well, he makes it clear. What have we to do with judging the world? We have nothing with which we can judge the world. Now, we preach the gospel. We teach them the truth. But we have nothing with which we can hold them accountable. And so any young person or any single person that's thinking about getting married and thinking about getting married to a spouse that is not a Christian, realize that. And I'm not trying to give people, you know, some matter of leverage. But think very seriously about the fact that you won't be able to get your husband to be a better husband on the fact that he should love you as Christ loved the church when he's not even a Christian. What's that mean to him? What's it mean to a wife to submit and respect her husband and love her husband as to the Lord when she doesn't even obey the Lord? You will have no ability to strengthen them and help them be a better spouse by the commands of Christ. Now, with Christians, again, not that we use this as leverage, but we have a reasonable ability to appeal to their Christianity. If I'm not being the husband that I ought to be, Heidi can point out that not only am I being the right husband, but in not being the right husband, I'm not being a good Christian. And if I am a Christian and I want to please Christ, that should mean something to me. And that should impact my desire to be a good husband. And the same with husbands for wives. You choose a spouse that's not a Christian, you won't ever be able to use that. And again, I don't mean that in a way of a weapon. I mean, you won't ever be able to influence them to be better than they ought to be because they should be a better Christian. And that's a very serious and sobering thing for people seeking married to think about. But moving on to verse 14, Paul gives the reasons why, even in the situation of a believer married to a non-believer, his command is the same. It's the same as it was to two believers. It was, don't divorce them. Verse 14 says, for the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. This is a somewhat strange verse to many people. I admit, I've kind of wondered about it many times. I hope that what I talk about here it makes sense and is helpful. But it seems like the people had the idea that because they were married to a non-believer, an outsider, a non-Christian, that somehow tainted their marriage. It made their marriage unclean, and maybe it even made them unclean. Now, if they have this view about sexual relations, even amongst married Christians, imagine what some of them thought about a marriage to a non-believer. And I would also suggest that this is probably a Jewish audience, primarily, that Paul's talking to here. You remember the old law, and God's law was very specific. You don't marry the outsider. You don't marry the pagan. And in fact, there were times, such as in Ezra and Nehemiah's times, when there was such rampant marriage and intermarriage amongst the heathen, and they had children, that Ezra and Nehemiah had actually commanded them to divorce. Now, God had said through Malachi, God hates divorce. But there was a time when the nation of Israel was so in danger that Ezra and Nehemiah forced the people to get divorced from their pagan spouses and even separate from the children that came from those as well. So you put that background, that Jewish background into Christianity, and now all of a sudden their Jewish spouse is not converting to Christianity. Or they see pagan spouses of some of their brothers and sisters that are not converting to Christianity, and they're applying the principles in Ezra and Nehemiah to New Testament Christianity. You need to get out of that relationship. You need to put away the one that is unclean because they are making your marriage unclean. But Paul says that the unbelieving husband is sanctified and the unbelieving wife is sanctified. Now, we've talked about the idea of sanctified. That means set apart. And in many times it speaks about salvation. Paul's not speaking about salvation here. Salvation is always individualistic. I can't save Heidi. Heidi can't save me. I can't save you. You can't save me. This is a principle taught all the way back in Ezekiel 18 and 20. The soul who sins shall die. The son shall not bear the guilt of the father, nor the father bear the guilt of the son. And it goes on. We are all responsible for our own salvation. And so Paul is not teaching that a spouse that refuses to come to obedience to the gospel is somehow saved because their spouse is saved. That's not what Paul is saying here. What Paul is simply saying is that unlike that case in Ezra and Nehemiah, the unbelieving spouse does not make the marriage unclean. The believing spouse makes the marriage clean. In God's eyes, the believing spouse makes that marriage acceptable and honorable and honored in the sight of God. And so it's a recognized, legitimate marriage in God's eyes. There's a lot of repercussions that come from that, I think, that I won't get into right now. But when someone comes to obey the gospel, even if their spouse doesn't, that marriage is sanctified by God. Now, what's this last phrase mean? Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. I think Paul is appealing to their sense of reason. Remember, if they want to use Ezra and Nehemiah's philosophy, in that case, they got rid of the children too. They sent those children from those marriages off with those spouses that they divorced. And Paul's not saying that they do that. Paul's saying, if you want to reason that the unbelieving spouse makes your marriage unclean, then these children that you have are unclean. And you have to put them away with your spouse. Now, would that be good or right for a Christian to send away their spouse and their innocent little children to be with a spouse that has clearly shown they have no desire to be a Christian? No, of course not. Paul's appealing to their sense of reason. That you don't think that these children are unclean. You recognize them as acceptable to God. They're not from some unclean marriage. And thus, the principle that the believer makes the marriage sanctified and honorable and respected in the sight of God. And because of this, because the marriage is accepted and right and accepted in the right of God, you don't divorce. That's the first reason. Because God accepts this marriage. And what God has joined together, let not man separate. Now, verse 15, the first kind of two phrases of verse 15, think of this as a parenthetical. This is, we're going to get to reasons 2 and 3 at the end of verse 15 and verse 16, but first, Paul mentions this parenthetical. He says, you don't depart, you don't divorce, but if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such a case. So here is, once again, an exception that Paul is mentioning with the scenario that he is describing. Now, imagine in the pagan Greco-Roman world, it would have been very likely that if one spouse obeyed the gospel and the other spouse did not, that spouse might not be content to continue living with a Christian. Or in the world of the Jews, if one spouse obeyed the gospel and one spouse did not, you can see why the spouse that did not might not tolerate their Christian wife or their Christian husband. And they might want to dissolve that marriage. They might seek to dissolve that marriage. Now, the Christian is not supposed to seek or initiate the divorce. But they are not obligated to maintain the marriage and to forcefully maintain the marriage if the non-Christian wants a divorce. That would have especially been important for men who might have had more of an opportunity to force their unbelieving wife to stay. And Paul says, no. If your non-believing spouse is not content to stay with you, if they don't want to continue the marriage and they insist on leaving, you let them depart. But then he says, a brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. This has been a case of concern or debate amongst a lot of people, because what some people see here is possibly a second exception. Just as Jesus gave an exception that would allow for divorce and then remarriage if the divorce is a result of sexual immorality, is Paul giving an exception here that in the situation of a believer and a non-believer, if the non-believer initiates the divorce and departs, the believer is then not only guiltless in the divorce, but then free to remarry? Well, a couple of considerations. And I don't know, by the way, that I'm going to answer your question, that question adequately or fully, A lot of people have a lot of different ideas, but here's a couple of considerations. First of all, the word that Paul uses for bound in this passage is different than the word that he uses in other places. There's two places where Paul talks about a wife being bound and then at liberty to remarry. And they both have to do with the death of her husband. 1 Corinthians 7:39, we'll see this later in the chapter. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives, but if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes only in the Lord. Romans 7:2 addresses this as well. Using marriage as an example, Paul says, for the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her, her husband as long as he lives, but if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. The point that I want to make here is the word that Paul uses for bound in these two passages is different than the word that Paul uses for bondage. It signifies something different. And even the release and the liberty that he mentions is different than this passage. So what I'm saying is the only other two times that we have Paul using language of saying that she is bound and then she is released to remarry is different than what Paul is talking about here. I think the reason is Paul is talking about not the bondage of being unmarried, but the bondage, she's not under bondage, as Christian is not under bondage to continue the relationship, to continue the marriage. It's not a bondage that they're freed from to then be remarried, but they don't need to look at themselves as being bound to that marriage and not allowing it to dissolve. They are to let the unbeliever depart. But secondly, and I think this is very important, remember the context. This is why contextual Bible study is so important. Many people go to this passage to justify divorce and remarriage when an unbeliever departs. But remember, what is Paul talking about? He's not talking about remarriage. It's not even in the scope of the conversation. He is not talking to people that are seeking to be married or remarried. He is talking to people that are seeking to be divorced and single. Forcing a discussion of remarriage based on a passage that is solely focused on don't divorce is to overlook the context and the purpose of this passage. And that's a dangerous way to read and interpret and apply the Bible. And thirdly, here's a quote that I thought helped out. Gordon Fee, in his commentary, says, our situation is usually made more complex because our concerns are often the precise opposite of theirs, which caused this to be written in the first place. They wanted to dissolve marriages. We want to know whether remarriage is permitted. The point being, don't use a passage that's not talking about remarriage to justify remarriage. That's an abuse of scriptures. But also, something else, lastly on this point, all the exceptions, remember, there's been exceptions given in all these cases so far. All of the other exceptions allow for a change in status, not a change in partners. To the unmarried and to the widows, those who did not have a spouse, Paul permitted them to be married. But they aren't changing partners, their spouse is gone. What he's allowing is a change in status from single to married. To the wife that he said, do not divorce your husband. But if she does depart, there's a small caveat, there's a small exception. But what is the exception? She goes from married to single. If that doesn't work out, if she decides that she doesn't like that, what is she allowed to do? She is allowed to change her status once again, but not from single to married to a new partner. She is allowed to change her status from single to her husband that she left. See, the exception allows for a change in status. Never in this passage does it allow for a change in partner. And so to say that this part, speaking about the Christian married to the non-believer, allows for not only a change in status, but a change in partner, again, seems to be grossly out of context of this passage. Does this passage condemn marriage or divorce and remarriage amongst a Christian and a non-believer? I wouldn't say it condemns it. It doesn't address it. And because it doesn't address it, it doesn't authorize it. And clearly the main thrust of the passage is don't divorce your spouse. Well, here's reasons 2 and 3. So that's the parenthetical. Now we get to the last two reasons of the initial command. What was the initial command? That the Christian not divorce their spouse. If this non-believer, whether Gentile or Jew, if they are content, even though they're not a Christian, to stay with the Christian, Paul says, you don't depart. Here's the second and third reason. He says, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? We are called as Christians to peace. This is the second reason. We are called to peace. Remember Romans 12 and 18. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. There are very few things in life that ruin peace, like divorce and separation. If a Christian spouse, even as a non-believer, is content and happy to remain with the Christian, then the Christian should not seek to cause strife and division and a destruction of peace through divorce. And then thirdly, Paul says, but how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? Again, don't take this out of context and use it to justify marrying outside of the Lord in the hopes that one day you'll save your spouse. But in the context that it is used, and when those choices are made, whenever for a reason a Christian finds themselves in the situation where they are married to an unbelieving spouse, the solution is not to absolve the marriage. The solution is to seek to save their soul. Now, Paul doesn't promise that that will happen. But he says you don't know. You never know. And so you keep at it. The best thing that a Christian can do when they find themselves in a marriage to a non-Christian is, first of all, obey the Lord. Above all else, obey the Lord. You let that spouse see that. They should know that the Lord comes first. When you go on family vacations, you're going to be at worship services. You're going to take the kids to worship services. You're going to do everything you can to serve the Lord. Secondly, in addition to obeying the Lord, you fulfill your role as a spouse. Chances are, if your spouse is not a Christian, they are not the spouse that they should be. I don't say that, by the way, to offend anyone here. I'm sure that some here who have spouses that are not Christians are very good people. But I think we've seen, I hope we've seen already in the studies that we're doing on the family, sometimes it's hard for us as Christians to be the husbands and the wives that we ought to be. It's that much harder for those that don't submit to the Lord's will. That is not an excuse. This is the point I'm trying to make. That is not an excuse for you not to be the husband or wife you ought to be. Whatever they might be, whatever their attitudes, their demeanor, their views of the church, you be the husband you ought to be, or you be the wife that you ought to be. Even if they don't deserve it, even if they don't act like they deserve it, you fulfill your role as a spouse. That's a part, by the way, of your obedience to the Lord. But you be a good example. In those things, that just comes naturally. You'll be a good example. And yes, also, teach them the truth. I don't know. I don't know that I have enough experience to honestly say the best way to do this. But I've heard many people that I trust say browbeating and nagging your non-believing husband or your non-believing wife is not a way that's going to get them to church. And it's not going to get them to obey the gospel. I'm not saying don't talk to them about the Bible. I'm not saying don't talk to them about spiritual things. I've seen people take that course. They never bring up religion with their non-believing spouse because they don't want an argument. That doesn't go well either. But realize that your example is going to do much more, in most cases, than your words. That's true in all spheres of life, but it's true in marriage as well. You be the best example you could be. You let them see your godly living every single day. And you don't know, I don't know, what that might do in 5, in 10, in 20, in 50 years, if God gives us that time. We've all seen it. We've seen it not happen. I've seen people that were non-believers. My grandfather I mentioned this morning was one. I can't remember how many years they're married, but all of my childhood he came to church. And never obeyed the gospel. I don't know why some people do that. But I've also seen stories of people that were just like my granddad. And every single person in the building, including their spouse, was heartbroken because they knew they were never going to obey the gospel until they did. And it overjoyed everybody. You don't know. Why break off something when it could possibly lead? Again, this is not an excuse to get married to an outsider. When you're in the situation already, don't break off a situation because it might lead to their salvation somewhere down the road. And then lastly, you pray. If there's something you can do when you're married to a non-believer, you pray and you pray and you pray. Morning, noon, and night, however often you can, you pray for them and you pray for their soul and you pray for their opportunity to obey the gospel. That'll do more than your words and it'll probably do more than your example. You pray for them. And maybe, just maybe, this isn't a promise, but maybe they just might come to the Lord themselves one day. And I assure you this, there is not mission field, foreign or domestic, that is sweeter when a soul is saved than in the walls of our home. Whether that's our children, or whether that's our spouse, or whether that's our parent. You devote yourself to that work and do everything you can to be the Christian you ought to be. And maybe they'll come to the Lord themselves one day. And that's why Paul gives the final reason. Don't separate. Don't divorce. Well, I'll bring the comments to a close with that. Again, I hope that what we've talked about here in this passage is helpful. And I hope it sheds some light in some way on these verses that we have considered together. I don't want to close without extending an invitation to any who might need to avail themselves of it. If you're here and you've not obeyed the gospel, you have an opportunity to do that tonight. To come believing, repenting of your sins, confessing the name of Christ as the Son of God, and being baptized for the remission of your sins. Or if you've done that, but you've let sin back in your life, change that today. Pray to God and repent, confess your sins and ask for His forgiveness. Or if it's of a public nature, come forward and confess those and we'll be happy. We'll be overjoyed to pray with you and for you so that you can be restored in God's sight once again. If there be one of either case, please come while we stand and while we sing.